Hello, I'm Laura Yuen, an editor at NPR News. Welcome to Spotlight on Anti-Asian Discrimination During COVID-19. The coronavirus has most, if not all of us, worried about our health and well-being. But for Asian Americans, there's yet another layer of anxiety. It's not just, will I or my loved ones get sick from this disease? Or will I lose my job? It's, what if someone lashes out at me or my family because we're Asian? Asian Americans across the country are reporting a wave of verbal and physical attacks against them in recent months due to perceived associations with the origins of the coronavirus in China. The FBI has also warned about a possible surge in hate crimes against Asians. My colleague Hannah Yang is an NPR News reporter based in southern Minnesota. Near the beginning of the stay-at-home orders, she was at her local grocery store when a couple suggested she looked diseased and should be sent back. Hannah was born in Ohio, but I don't think that's where they meant. She wrote that she had dealt with racist remarks in this country growing up, but now she said, quote, "The discrimination feels somehow different, even dangerous. In my small, largely white community, I do worry that some see me as nothing more than an embodiment of COVID-19. To get at that wider concern, we hosted a virtual event and with audience questions from a secure web chat to prevent Zoom hate bombing, and spoke with guests who have a lot of experience and insight on what this moment means for Asian Minnesotans. Erica Lee is a Regents Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of the recently published book, America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Bo Tao Urabe is a social entrepreneur and founder and executive director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. Rebecca Lucero is the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. She co-chairs the Community Resiliency and Recovery Workgroup that Governor Walz launched in April. Its focus is to center the communities of color, indigenous people, and immigrants in the state's response to the pandemic. Sam Oak is the Equity and Multilingual Program Coordinator at Faribault Public Schools. He works to help students overcome barriers he faced as a refugee from Cambodia. And I opened the conversation asking Bo Tao Urabe how she thinks she's being perceived by fellow Americans, fellow Minnesotans these days, and if it's different than before the pandemic.
I mean, I think, you know, since the pandemic started, I think that we've heard a lot from communities about their sense of feeling different and that somehow they are being seen as different because of the association to China and some of our top leaders associating it to Chinese and thereby, I think, causing people to have that kind of perception. And so I have been hearing a lot about it. I think personally, I do worry. I mean, you know, I can't control what people perceive me to be, but I think in light of everything, I do feel more cautious. But it hasn't stopped me from being able to do things that I would normally do. But I know that for people who have been harassed or received racial abuse or those kinds of things, that it has really been concerning for the community. And there's a sense of isolation and fear about what might happen if they do the normal things that they normally do in their neighborhoods or at the grocery store or just being out in public. And so it does feel like there is a type of targeting that is happening, that whether something has actually happened or not, there is a perception that something is different because of our outward appearances.
Let's go to you, Sam Oak. How are things for you and the people you work with?
You know, I have not experienced any difference. I mean, I live and work in a small town where a lot of us know each other. So there has not been that difference. But I think, like Bo said, we are practicing social distancing now. A lot of us are quarantined. So maybe when things get opened up again, we might experience more of some of those things that you see in social media on, you know, some of the hate activities targeting Asian Americans. But at the moment, not much has changed for me here.
Yeah, I guess we should note that, you know, school will eventually reopen, and that is a place where kids can expect or have received racist remarks from other students. What about you, Erica Lee?
I've been fortunate in that I also have not experienced some of these horrific hate crimes. There was an incident early in the winter when a fellow patient, a doctor's clinic, moved her chair farther away from me. I don't know whether it was just a overabundance of caution in terms of ensuring that there was social distance between us, or, and I think this is the question that Asian Americans are asking, you know, all the time these days, is it because I am Chinese American or appear, you know, Asian American? As a historian, you know, I unfortunately know that during times of crises and also during times of peace, Asian Americans have always been vulnerable to these types of discrimination and prejudice and bigotry related to a foreign threat. It happened during World War II, of course, leading to the incarceration of Japanese Americans. It happened during the Vietnam War. You know, this is just an enduring aspect of American racism directed at Asian Americans, that we're constantly associated with something foreign rather than American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we definitely will ask you more about this historical context, because you are a leading scholar on xenophobia in this country today. Commissioner Lucero, your office has established a helpline for folks to report acts of discrimination and bias during this pandemic. What kind of stories are you hearing?
Thank you so much for that question. We've been receiving calls throughout Minnesota, and we've been hearing stories of the pain and backlash. And a lot of what we just heard from everyone on the panel here about the uncertainty and the fear from the Asian American community as we're moving through COVID-19. And, you know, before I kind of share some of those stories and themes, I think it's just helpful to briefly overview the helpline and kind of discuss the process at the agency.
Go right ahead.
So the purpose of the helpline is to hear directly from community about what everyone is experiencing. So if it's a violation of the Human Rights Act, we're able to investigate it and potentially determine if there's discrimination that occurred and maybe even litigate it or settle the case out. But if it's bias, we are tracking that, and we're looking for opportunities for education, for outreach, partnership with community groups, policy change.
Can you describe what is the difference between a comment that is biased or an act of bias and a violation of the Human Rights Act?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Minnesota Human Rights Act is one of the strongest civil rights laws in the country, and it protects all Minnesotans because everyone is part of a protected class. And everyone has a race, a sex. We have multiple protected class statuses. And so, but the areas that the act protects are areas such as employment, housing, education. And so some examples of discrimination that fall under the act of, let's say that you went to the grocery store and the grocery store won't allow you to come into the grocery store, maybe because of your race. And since we're talking about COVID-19, maybe because that you're Asian and they believe you're at risk for spreading COVID-19. That would be a legal discrimination based on race. Another example is, let's say your landlord isn't allowing you to access your apartment because they think you're at risk for COVID-19. That could be a legal discrimination as well. So what doesn't fall under the Human Rights Act on its own is if somebody is yelling at you, things like go back to your country, or you're the reason the virus is here, in, like, for instance, a parking lot or a park, and the person-on-person interactions, and that's what we're hearing a lot of. So those incidents are bias, discrimination for sure, and sometimes even rise to the level of hate crimes. For those incidents, we look to do outreach and education, partner with community groups, and policy changes. So you can imagine if we're hearing about a lot of incidents happening in one neighborhood, we can work with the community groups in that neighborhood to do some healing, including building a more welcoming and inclusive space in that neighborhood.
And would you say that a lot of the stories that you have been hearing fall into that camp? You know, hateful speech, getting accosted verbally in a parking lot or at a grocery store?
Yeah, certainly when it comes to COVID-19 as it relates to API community. And I think there's a few themes that we've seen. So yeah, for the most part, right now, Minnesotans, Asian Minnesotans are experiencing bias at grocery stores and parking lots. And that's because that's where folks are. So we're hearing a lot of examples, like the example you shared, You know, one person called and said, my father was confronted in front of a grocery store in Maplewood by another customer who told my father to return to China. The man grabbed my father's jacket really violently. We have stories before distance learning started of students experiencing bias at schools. So my child's friend was bullied at school because the other student thought they were Chinese. And so as we start to think about going back to school, or even just opening up broadly, we're going to see these incidents occurring in more places. When we are receiving reports of bias, we're actually seeing quite a bit on behalf of parents. And so grown adults calling on behalf of their mom or their dad. And so we're seeing a lot of that happen. And so, yeah, I think you're seeing a lot of people being yelled at in public. So it's not institutions. It's not the bank not letting you in. It's not your landlord not letting you in. It's people yelling at people. There is, for instance, a situation that we heard about where a woman was riding her bike and a driver rolled down his window and started yelling, you should go back to your country. And it was a really scary situation for her. And so these are the kind of stories that we have. I do want to make sure people know the number to the discrimination helpline. It's 1-833-454-0148. And there's also a form that can be filled out at online through our website at mn.gov/mdhr. And if anyone sees or experiences bias or discrimination, they can contact us. And of course, if you're witnessing or experiencing a hate crime, please call the police.
Thanks, Commissioner. And while you were describing that moment of the woman who was, you know, verbally accosted by someone driving by, go back to where you came from, I literally saw Sam kind of grimace. Yeah. And I just wonder, Sam, you know, did that take you back to something?
Yeah, it hurts me. It pains me a lot because, like Commissioner said, you know, some of these hateful acts aren't institutionalized, but they're the ones that make you feel even more vulnerable because they're up in your face and they make you really feel like you want to do something. And if you don't, you feel even more weak and vulnerable. And to me, it takes me back to the time when we were early refugees here in the United States, myself being from Cambodia here. You know, I remember a time when my mother couldn't even get in the bus without having gum put on her hair. Actually, one of my very first memories of being alive was when I was 4 years old playing outside and a group of teenagers rode their bikes on by making funny noises, pretending it was an Asian language and spat on me. You know, and a lot of these acts that back then led many of us who were young teens and young adults at the time to turn to gangs. People think that, well, these are confused kids, and maybe that was some of it. You know, I mean, we grew up in a time where we go to school and many people don't welcome us as Americans. But then when we go back home, we're not Cambodian enough. We're not Asian enough. So that was part of it. But the bigger part of it is because we did not feel safe and welcome. So a lot of us turned to gangs. And I, sadly, I even have people ask me now, should we bring back those days? Should we restart the Royal Cambodian Bloods or whatever to protect ourselves against some of these potential hateful acts that could come our way? And for someone who's lived through that lifespan, I really hope we don't go back to that time. You know, Commissioner has stated and Bo has mentioned in the past that education is very important. And I think at every opportunity, even when school gets reopened or even during this time here, we should really reach out to our youth and let them know that if you are at risk of experiencing any of these things, there is a right way, a positive way to fight back against this that will keep you and your family healthy and so that they don't revert back to some of the things that may make them feel powerful at the time, but could hurt them later on in the long run.
Yeah. And Sam, you and I talked yesterday about this notion somehow that, you know, this is the first time, I'm doing air quotes for people can't see, the first time that Asian Americans are experiencing prejudice and racism. And certainly that is not the case. There's a long history of racism towards Asians in this country.
And I feel, you know, really offended when I hear that, you know, well, you know, Asians, this is just our turn now to experience some of this hate and some of this prejudice, because it's absolutely not true. I'm offended, but I, in a way, I'm even I'm more saddened by it. Professor had mentioned about the history a little bit about our struggles here in America. And I feel like people who believe this or who think that this is the first time that Asians have experienced any hate or any discrimination really highlights more the invisibility of our struggles here in the United States and really even the invisibility of our contributions here in the United States. Professor Lee had mentioned, you know, anti-Japanese sentiments. You know, I mean, we've had policies put out against us, the Chinese Exclusion Act, and even more greater, the Asian Exclusion Act that people probably are not aware of, that really kept a lot of us from being able to call America home. And that was, again, repeated, you know, when our refugees came from Southeast Asia. And there's research out there that says that the refugee journey doesn't end until you're able to rediscover home. And if we're not able to call America our home here, then we continue this refugee journey. And, you know, hope is a very important thing. Hope carried us through the wars, the areas of conflict into the refugee camp, and then it carried us out of the refugee camp here to the United States. But what happens when hope dies here in the United States and you're not welcome here and you're not allowed to live, you know, as a human being? And that's what I worry most about, because if you know, some of these acts right now, people don't look at us as humans. They think we're a virus. And they don't treat us, I mean, you know, sometimes they treat us worse than animals. And I worry that if we continue to get treated like this and we continue to get pushed in the corner, eventually we will fight back. And I hope that our youth are prepared to fight back in a positive and healthy way that would further themselves and their families and not get themselves into bigger trouble.
You know, Erica Lee, you have written a lot about xenophobia in the United States, going back to, as Sam said, the Chinese Exclusion Act of the 1880s. What can we learn from our history, and how can it help understand what we might be experiencing today?
Sam said it really well. This is a long history that's not just rooted in the long relationship of Asians in America, but is grew upon and helped to expand the already existing racism affecting African Americans, American Indians, Latinx peoples. These are all interconnected ways of discriminating against peoples of color and emphasizing how they are less than or outside of what the ideal American, which historically has been a white American. So I think it's really important to understand not only this is a long history that Asians have experienced, but also that it is absolutely built upon and helped expand the larger system of racism. So some of the lessons is not only that this is something that continues to cycle through, but also how it has always lumped together so many diverse Asian American groups as one monolithic threat. And this is another way that racism works, and it's also, unfortunately, another way that helps to amplify division. You know, during World War II, Korean Americans and Chinese Americans were often mistaken for being Japanese Americans. Some of the responses in those communities were very divisive. They would actually wear pins or labels that said, "I'm Chinese, not Japanese." You know, so one of the lessons from the past should be, I would hope, that that this is affecting all of us, and that the actions and response also have to be rooted in a, you know, pan-Asian American as well as across racial alliances and understandings. I think especially here in Minnesota, we know that so many of the people who are experiencing this kind of hate are not Chinese American, and that should show us, you know, how widespread and active this kind of racism continues to be today.
Oh, Otao Urabe.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to chime in when Sam was talking to just share that I think a lot of what people are experiencing and expect to see are the personal or interpersonal incidents, and it's almost like if that isn't happening, then that's not what people are worried about, is not real, right? And I think that what we also know to be true is that anti-Asian sentiments right now span the gamut of both the interpersonal acts of, you know, bias, discrimination, and violence to then also people deciding not to visit Asian businesses like restaurants or those kinds of places. And I know that before we were sheltered at home, I went to see, to eat at one of the restaurants, and they were saying how their business had significantly decreased and that they felt that some of that is happening because of the perceived, you know, Asian owners and obviously Asian food and Asian, you know, business and things like that. So that when we're talking about a sentiment that targets a community, it spans really both the interpersonal, but also has economic impacts and it has community impact. And I think to, you know, Commissioner Lucero's point, when someone yells out of a window to tell you to go back home and it's in your neighborhood, it makes you feel a little less safe, right? You tend to think that that's the place where you should feel most comfortable. And so people do that. What does a community do? And then I think, you know, Dr. Lee's point about there is systemic consequences for a community as broad as the Asian American community. And I don't think that we want to get into a position where I, as a Hmong person, have to say I'm not Chinese, as if targeting Chinese makes it better, right? That's not the point. The point is that there is an assumed identity and that the problem that we are facing now is being linked to a whole community without us to actually being able to spend the time talking to each other about how, you know, how we are going to collectively get through this and what does it mean to care for each other in this moment. Because what is different about the anti-Asian targeting now, and I think and the same, is that like history, it's a crisis, but this is a global pandemic where every part of the world is impacted, and that there are new forms in which people are experiencing this anti-Asian targeting, right? So we held a seminar with a webinar with Dr. Lee and Commissioner Lucero, and we were Zoom bombed. That's a new way, right? We did all that we could to make sure our space was protected without silencing our audience. But the same thing that you've had to do today, because we just don't know who's going to jump on. And when they target us, it's not just anti-Asian sentiments. They were, you know, anti-Semitic. They were anti-Black. They were, you know, so I think that kind of silencing is very hard to control in social media and creates a new environment for this kind of hatred to breed. And I think those are, you know, that's what makes people feel unsafe. And if you've ever experienced being the target of something because of your identity, you know exactly how it feels. So every time it happens, even though it might be on social media, you're quickly able to return to that place in your body, in your mind. Yeah. And so people are re-traumatized, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, here you are having a virtual Zoom meeting for the community about xenophobia and racism and who should show up, but, you know, xenophobic people and racists. So they kind of proved your point that day, then, didn't they? Mm-hmm. You know, for those of us who have experienced harassment or discrimination, we know how powerful it can be for someone to intervene, to step up and say, that's not right. For those listening today who aren't Asian American, what are ways they can support this community? Commissioner, would you like to take that? You're nodding your head there.
Sure. I'm happy to take that. I'm very expressive too. So I'm always nodding my head about everything. So yeah, I think this is a really important question because this is a time where we really need to be stepping up. So we've talked about how racism and xenophobia are deeply built into our country. We've talked about how it's been here before this moment. It'll be here after this moment. And I think something that Bo said that's super important is that this is a time of particular heightened fear and uncertainty, and also just really naming that this is also a pandemic. Our loved ones are sick, our loved ones are dying, we're facing incredible economic fallout. And so it's a time where we really need to be caring for each other, especially where there is this heightened bias, discrimination, and racism, xenophobia occurring. And so then I think that we are seeing many incidents of bystander people stepping up and saying, hey, this discrimination that's happening is not okay. And in fact, in the helpline, we've actually had a couple bystanders call or folks call in and say, hey, this horrible thing happened to me. And somebody came in and said something and it meant a lot to me. And so it really ripples when people stand up and do something and say, this is not okay. So there was a story of somebody who was in St. Paul, who is Asian, who was treated horribly at a grocery store because of anti-COVID bias. And I think either an owner or a manager stepped in and said, actually kicked the person who was harassing them out, went back to the shopper and said, hey, you are welcome here. Is there anything else you need? Can I help you? They called the helpline to report that. And so it makes a difference. So that's one thing that people can do, is just remember how important it is to be a bystander and step up against discrimination. I think the second thing is to remember that right now it's the legislative session that's going on, and there's a lot of really important bills that are moving. And importantly, some of those bills, two things. One, really support and fund community organizations that are on the ground doing this work and training and doing the healing work, doing the partnership work that is occurring every single day, which is the best kind of outreach and education that will occur. And so those bills need tremendous support right now. And then the second category of bills have to do with just the incredible support system that's needed. So increases to MFIP, housing support. And so it's always hard to engage with legislators. This is particularly hard. And I think everyone, what you can do to really support is speak up right now. And then I think the last thing is just to really lead with just a tremendous amount of love right now. In these moments of fear and uncertainty, we can really pull back into those moments. And it's going to take a lot of effort to lead with love, letting people know they're welcomed, valued, send notes of appreciation. So not just stand up when there's something wrong, but actively speak up and let people know that they're valued and appreciated and loved.
That's a great segue. I'm going to get into the question of self-care in a bit. I just want to take a break to say you're listening to Spotlight on Anti-Asian Discrimination during COVID-19. We'll be back with more on this. I'm Laura Yuen.
Welcome back to Spotlight on Anti-Asian Discrimination during COVID-19. I'm Laura Yuen. I recently hosted an event with Erica Lee, a Regents Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the University of Minnesota, Bo Tao Urabe, a social entrepreneur and founder and executive director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, Rebecca Lucero, the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and Sam Oak, the equity and multilingual program coordinator at Faribault Public Schools. And we continued our conversation about the rise in anti-Asian discrimination with some quick mental health stats. National studies show that Asian Americans are accessing mental health care at much lower rates than other cultural groups in the U.S., and they report discrimination or prejudice most as obstacles for care. So I asked Bo Tao Urabe what self-care looks for her in this intense time.
Yeah, I think we're hearing a lot about people really just checking in on each other, and that in some ways the community is very good at kind of collective care. And so that has really lent itself to this moment of crisis where I think people are really trying to really be there for each other and to really create kind of space. I know in my family, we've had Zoom calls, family Zoom calls. We've done some, to the extent possible, some drop-ins with appropriate social distancing, dropping off food for each other and those kinds of things. I also want to say that we are also trying to really support people in utilizing telehealth options to get to talk to someone if they need to, but also I think the community has created tremendous space for truth telling. I think, you know, what people most know best is themselves. And so we know that in our spaces where we have created so that young people can talk to each other because they feel extremely ignored and disengaged by everything that is happening with adults solving problems for a lot of things that young people are talking. And so we're hosting a virtual space just for young people. They're creating TikTok videos for each other, those kinds of things, along with also mutual aid, just the generosity of the community to step in this moment to say, how do I utilize the language skills that I have so that the elder who doesn't speak English can access some support, or, you know, I'm connected to this organization or this community. And so how do we leverage that in this moment? So we've been very fortunate here at Cal to provide some small funds for leaders who are utilizing those skills and their influence to be able to serve the community in this moment. And I think that people are really stepping up and doing that. So I think self-care both involves truth-telling to be able to express what is happening in your own lives so that other people can be there for you or hold space for you to just share that. But it also involves taking care of the community. And so even though we often talk about care as being the self is only well when the collective is well. So I think we are seeing a lot of the community really stepping up in that way. I don't think that there is enough mental health support for the community just because there is so much in the barriers or challenges with language. Just there weren't enough providers to start out with. And in this time, we are hearing about those challenges, right? So we're doing the best that we can to connect people. But I do think that where people are shining or doing really well is really those personal relationships that they have and then utilizing the skills and resources that they have to support the community at this time.
I also want to ask the same question about self-care to Erica Lee, because, you know, your life's work is looking into very troubling issues of xenophobia. Are you allowed to like take a break from your research and, you know, put that out for a moment and care for yourself?
Yeah, it's been a challenging couple of years to be writing about xenophobia and racism, not only because this is such a deeply rooted history in our country, but also because things are getting replicated and expanded at a very rapid rate, not only in the U.S., but also globally. So I just like everyone else, I have my moments of sticking my head in the sand and binge watching and doing other types of things where I'm sort of just, you know, plugging my ears and taking a break. But I also know that what feeds me personally is being part of conversations like these, being connected with the other folks on the panel who are, you know, doing such heroic work in our communities and spreading the message of self-care, but also activism. And I also find a great deal of inspiration in lots of the various campaigns that have been happening nationally and locally to raise attention to the hate crimes, to create very creative outlets to challenge this narrative, but also to continue to see journalists talking back, for example, to the president and calling attention to some of the ongoing conflations of China and Asian Americans. So as a historian, I know too well how many times there seem to be periods of helplessness. And I feel that we really are at a tipping point where we can draw on, you know, generations of activists and generations of building coalitions across groups to really recognize that we are all in this together and that the only way to get out of this is also together.
I'm getting some really great questions already from the audience. Our first question is from Jeff. He says, has there been an increase in overt acts of xenophobia and racism against Asians and Asian Americans in the past 3 or 4 years? Is the pandemic just amplifying what already exists?
I'll just say that I think that first that reporting of hate or bias acts are, I mean, there's generally underreporting, right? It's something that many, many people experience in this country, but across the country, there is no consistency in how that information is captured. And so only in this crisis moment have there been sites set up. And so we know that Asian American led organizations across the country have done so. And in New York State, they've also established a line that is connected to the AG's office. And here we've established a line connected to the Department of Human Rights. So that information is very new. But I know that across the country, nationally, there definitely is an uptick and the data that those who are the Asian American organizations have led in creating demonstrate that, that in the last 2 months, there's been over 2,000 incidents across the country in all parts of the country. So it's not limited to one area. And then here in Minnesota, we began, but after the shelter at home, right?
Thanks, Bo. Commissioner, do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I would just add that hate crimes are actually and have been increasing across the country for the past several years across the board. There's been increased rates of anti-Semitism, increased rates of anti-Muslim rhetoric, certainly a lot of anti-Mexican, anti-Brown rhetoric. And then, you know, trans women has had seen a remarkable increase in hate crimes. Black trans women in particular are dying at really high rates. COVID-19 has exposed some real ugliness against the Asian community. And this is part of a time period where there's a lot of bias and discrimination and hate crimes increasing across the country. I think that there's been a real acceptance of rhetoric that is an us versus them rhetoric, a fear mentality. And so we're in this moment right now, and it demonstrates to us how all of these levels of oppression are interconnected, and it requires us to see how we can all push against this together across the board. And I really want to just acknowledge the incredible work of Bo and all of the community leaders there who have been naming the intersectionality of oppression that's going on as you've been addressing the anti-Asian rhetoric that's going on. It's been incredibly powerful to see.
Erica Lee, it sounds like you wanted to add something.
The commissioner beat me to it. And okay. I just want to make that connection to Islamophobia rising, not just after 9/11, but rising specifically since 2015, and how that not only impacts Muslim and Muslim Americans, but also Asian Americans who are often Muslim themselves or mistaken for being Muslim or Arab American.
We have a question from Cabo. She says, can the commissioner share more about what are effective strategies for outreach and education related to this? Commissioner Russo?
Yeah, for that question, I would actually really defer to community leaders on effective outreach and communication strategies. I think the community leaders are the ones who are on the ground who know best for what needs to happen for the healing and outreach. And that's why it's an important partnership when it comes to the helpline to gather the information and make sure we're getting that back to community. I think it can depend on the situation. So for instance, where we're seeing a lot of information coming in around grocery stores, there could be an opportunity to partner directly with grocery stores to be more, to be very outgoing about their support of creating a welcoming environment for their customers, and specifically naming that Asian community members are welcome in their store. And so that's, for instance, a strategy that can work there in grocery stores where we are seeing an uptake of things. But I would defer to community groups.
I have a question from Christine. She says, I am Caucasian. My 14-year-old son is Korean, I am worried about him being harassed when he starts going out again. I am not worried about school, but more about him in public spaces with friends, like at the Mall of America or going to a movie. What advice do I give him on how to handle it? As a 14-year-old, he doesn't always think every interaction through. Well, those of us who have kids, yeah, we know this is a tough conversation. And I guess we're all searching for what can we tell our children?
Well, Sam could probably contribute to this,
yeah,
because you work with so many students. But I do want to say that the school environment is really important, because before we were sheltered at home, we were paying attention to what else was happening across the country. And there were lots of incidences of in the school environment. And so while your friends may be surrounded by friends who may not do that, you don't always know. And so there were some targeting of students between students, but also some bullying incidences between teachers who sort of would put the Asian kid in the corner or things like that. And so, you know, thinking about how we work with schools to talk about this moment, I would just say that, you know, as a mother myself, I talk to my daughter and she's 9 years old, and I just tell her what's happening, and that, you know, that for her to know that, you know, this is what our community looks like, and here's what people are thinking. And if something happens, that she should tell me, because I let her out in, you know, in on our streets, and I don't really know, right? But I don't want to stop her from doing that. But I don't want to also not tell her that if something happens, there's a reason, right? So I do think that being able to just talk. This is a great opportunity to talk about, learn from history, that what is happening now is not something new that we haven't experienced before. We have, and understand that history, and the more that we can teach our children so that they are able to talk about race and racism and xenophobia in this country, that it bodes better for all of us to then work together to say, what can we do? I know we've worked with both St. Paul and Minneapolis Public Schools on their statements to just provide advice on what it is that they can do for their staff and their students and parents at this time. But also there's going to have to be more things done so that we can at this moment support educators to be able to think through this with their kids.
Sam Oak, what are you telling your, you're a dad yourself, right?
I am. I'm a father of a little 3-year-old boy.
Okay.
So I haven't talked to him about that yet. If I can get to that point a little bit later, I just want to continue what Bo had been talking about. I think teachers have a very important role to play, and they are put in a very powerful position to affect this issue in a positive way. The worst thing that teachers and also, you know, just people in general can do is to not talk about it, and is to avoid it like it didn't happen, just because it doesn't happen in your area or in your social network. You know, so for teachers, it is very important to bring these things up in discussion in your classroom. You can do it right now during distance learning. Just talk about some of the things that are going on, some of the positive way that our youth can help each other through it, and how can we show care for each other and support each other through it. Even if you don't have Asian kids in your classroom, it's important to talk about it, because they're going to encounter an Asian person, you know, in their life at some point, and even during this time here too. So it is very important to take away any of the biases and discrimination out there that is in that could be possibly be laying in a person's mental psyche. As a parent, telling your children to be careful going out and all that, and having that concern, that's very, very normal. I think, you know, having lived through some of the discrimination and harassment myself growing up, I think the best thing that you can do to tell your kid is that you have to be careful. And it is better to walk away. And again, this is not anything new. I think going back to what Commissioner Lucero had mentioned, you can't beat anger with anger. You can't beat hate with hate. You have to do that with love. And so when people do some things that are hateful towards you, that can cause you to be angry, getting angry and pushing back in an aggressive way may not be the right answer at the time. So it is better to walk away, take out your aggression, and talk about it with people that care about you, and then talk through those situations, and that will help you feel better. It's not worth it. It's not worth it to step into something if somebody were to challenge you or call you names, to escalate the situation and get into bigger problems. That doesn't do well for yourself. It caused pain on your family, and it caused pain on the other person as well, too. And in this moment here, causing more pain is not the way to go.
Well said. Final question from the audience comes from Mark. What other actions is the state of Minnesota taking or planning to take to protect the Asian American community from COVID-19 related backlash, harassment, racist comments? The helpline is a good resource, but some incidents will not rise to violations of state law, whether civil or criminal. Thus, certain individuals will feel empowered to continue discriminating against Asian Americans. Commissioner Lucero, can you take that question?
Sure. I mean, it's a complicated question because that's correct. People who are going to use this moment to choose to amplify hate and bias are going to do that. People will continue to do that after this moment for different populations, and they did that before this moment for different populations. So hate and discrimination is not new. It's how we continue to organize and respond to that and to insist upon a world where we are not creating that. I mean, most importantly is that the systems that are in place do not lead to discrimination. And I think that ultimately, at the end of the day, as was discussed here, it's never too late to build solidarity. And now is very much the time to be building solidarity. And so that's why partnering with community groups, partnering with everyone who's on the ground doing this is going to be really important. I also think that's why it's really important to have the data and the stories. And so, because when we have those stories, we better understand where we can respond. If we understand there's tension points, then we can bring in, for instance, community mediators, or we can bring in specific outreach opportunities or education opportunities, or maybe even change some policies. It is not an easy fix to undo hatred in people's hearts. And that's why I think I said that it's really important that we choose to lead with love and undo discrimination and bias at the same time.
I want to end on a hopeful note, because obviously the Asian American community in Minnesota is much more than a group of people experiencing really awful things. I'm curious if any of you have stories to tell about how Asian Minnesotans are making a difference during this time. Sam. Sam Oak. Sam, I'm picking up on people's expressions here.
No. Oh. Well, my wife is a pharmacist at Gillette Children's, and she goes to work every day, you know, putting herself at risk. But she always goes in with a smile and comes back home, you know, with a smile. We're really proud of what she does and the people that she's able to help. So I'm very proud of my wife and people like her who continues to help, you know, the community and goes out and enjoys what she's doing.
Yeah, I'll just add too that, you know, we've had a couple of virtual concerts in which artists and, you know, performers have just hosted those spaces to bring music and art to the community. And I think that's really much needed space right now for people to have other outlets. But also, you know, here at Cal, we had a fund that we were specifically called our Spark Leadership Fund, in which we in the past had used it to support Asian Minnesotan leaders who were doing incredible things in their communities. But this year, we opened it up to support all Black, Indigenous, Latinx communities. And it's been so incredibly rewarding watching the incredible efforts that people are taking and initiative on to support their community. So I get a lot of joy in this moment of pain from seeing what people are putting forth, and that our little resources could enable them to do a lot of good. So I'm incredibly proud about that.
That was Bo Tao Urabe, founder and executive director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, talking about where we are at this moment in time and a reminder of the resilience of the Asian American community in Minnesota. She was joined on the panel by Sam Oak, the Equity and Multilingual Program Coordinator at Faribault Public Schools, Rebecca Lucero, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and Erica Lee, a Regents Professor of History and Asian American Studies at the University of Minnesota. This has been Spotlight on Anti-Asian Discrimination During COVID-19. This program was produced in part by Call to Mind, Minnesota Public Radio's initiative to foster new conversations about mental health. I'm Laura Ewan with NPR News.